Welcome to A Life Lived Backwards, One Man's Life, the accompanying podcast to Larry Ruttman's memoir, A Life Lived Backwards, an existential triad of friendship, inquisitiveness, and maturation. Hi there, I'm Jordan Rich with a pretty easy task and a fun one at that. I pose questions to Larry, and with that razor-sharp memory of his and a great talent for storytelling, well, you just have to settle back and enjoy the ride. Today, Larry, we take you to Wellfleet, which is a part of the Cape Cod experience and something that you've experienced for many, many years. And the Wellfleet Historical Society, you've been connecting with them and they've been connecting with you for many years. We're going to share some stories.
Well, actually, they haven't been connecting with me for many years. And maybe the truest way to express that is I haven't been connecting with them, because although Lois and I have had a house in Wellfleet since 1977, which is actually half my lifetime, and we've enjoyed it very much, we have not been terrifically active, well, more active than I thought when I began to think about it, but certainly not involving the Wellfleet Historical Society, which actually was somewhat moribund over the years. But now they're under new leadership. And the new leadership did something. They wrote me a letter last winter, and they said, we're going to do an oral history project, and of course, to accentuate and bring forth Wellfleet history. And of course, Wellfleet has a great history, whaling in the 18th century and fishing in the 19th century, other forms of commerce, and now it's big as far as tourism is concerned. And also a lot of very famous people, Nobel laureates and so forth, have come there to either live or, for the most part, have second homes. And all through this history is the Wellfleet oyster, the most famous oyster in the world.
See that on menus everywhere, right?
That's right. I mean, you know, if you go to London, Wellfleet oyster, that's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And they're good. Boy, if you get good Wellfleet oysters, you can't beat them. So I got interested in that, and I said, boy, it would be interesting to interview some of these people. Well, I submitted my name, and it's a bit of a long story. They didn't respond right away, so I wrote to them again in my persistent way that I learned from my mother. And lo and behold, they got a hold of me. And they told me about a number of people that they wanted to interview, quite well-known people that didn't want to be interviewed by the Wellfleet Historical Society. And it turned out later that I found out that they had been put off dismissed by former non-historian heads of the Wellfleet Historical Society who didn't know an historical story when they looked one in the face. And so I became their go-to. So I said, I might be able to get that person. So in short order, after they interviewed me, which was nice, and I found out how many connections to Wellfleet I really did have over those 40-odd years, I became their guy to bring into the fold people who had initially refused to be interviewed.
Well, let me just interject and suggest that you're a historian by nature anyway. You love history. You've written about baseball history and Jewish American history and music. I mean, so this is right in your bailiwick.
Well, it is, Jordan. And as a matter of fact, I used to describe myself as an attorney at law, Esquire. Now I describe myself as author, historian, and with a bow to you, Jordan, podcast.
Yes, with a capital P, by the way. So let's talk about some of these people that you were able to corral and what impact they've had.
They're really interesting people. And the first one that I see that I wanted to talk to you about is Joan Hopkins. Now, Joan Hopkins is a lovely lady, now in her mid-80s. And she's married to a guy that's really famous, Jack C-O-U-G-H-L-I-N. I always pronounced it Coughlin. But he pronounces it Jack Coughlin, or Coughlin, and he is an artist of real note on both sides of the Atlantic, and he is married to Joan, and Joan and Jack have had the Golden Cod Gallery in Wellfleet, one of the many artistic art galleries there, since maybe over 50 years, and they live right above it. And they're both great people, although each of them is different from the other. She's in her mid-80s now. He's in his early 90s. And Jack and I were always very friendly. I used to go out on his boat, and I would go down there and talk to her, and I'd see him. And, you know, so I thought to myself, maybe I can convince them. Well, Joan told me a story that she was very active in the Wellfleet Historical Society, but someone once gave her the back of their hand. She's not a person that gets upset easily, but she got upset with that. She told me that story, and of course she told Jack, and Jack was upset with it as well. So they both refused to be interviewed. But I wrote to them, and they refused again. But then as a few weeks went on and I kept in contact with them, they finally said yes. And let me tell you about Joan Hopkins. She has a big history in Wellfleet. Her family came from Wellfleet. The Hopkins family is well known in Wellfleet. They go back, at least 150 years. And Joan, however, had business in Jamaica and wound up living in Jamaica. And she grew up in Jamaica, but not without coming back to Wellfleet from time to time. So she was intimately acquainted with Wellfleet history going back 150 years or more. And she could talk about all that. She could also talk about her artistic abilities, which she began learning very early on in Jamaica. Now, Lois and I have a picture of hers in our house. She paints very colorfully. It's a Jamaican scene. And every time I walk down from the third level to the second level, I see that picture, and it's a lovely picture, and it speaks so well of her. We have several of Jack's works around the house. One, he used to do famous people. This was a Mozart that he did.
Oh, you have to have that. That's
beautiful.
No, I
have to have that one. And another one he did that he didn't do a lot of landscapes, but something of his lost color, maybe it was a watercolor, but he paints in all mediums. He painted oil and acrylic and God knows what. And so that it lost something. So he said, I can fix that. So he changed it into a landscape of Wellfleet. And it's very nice. And that hangs in our house down there. And I would say that when I interviewed Joan, she told me lots of stories about Wellfleet. There's a part of Wellfleet that's off in the corner of Wellfleet called Bound Brook. It's about 2 or 3 miles from the center of town. That's where all the fisher folk used to reside in the 19th century, mostly. And it was dangerous. You know, fishing is dangerous. And some of them lost their lives. And but they made a living out of it. But then when they saw that a lot of commerce was coming to Wellfleet Center, they decided to move their homes, literally, to the center of Wellfleet, and that's how Bound Brook became sort of abandoned, and it became a place where people lived, including my good friend Ike Williams, who's a quite well-known, now retired, book agent and author, and handsome guy that the women all loved, and he and I occasionally would walk along the beach with our dogs, and he was always very kind to my literary ambitions, even though he represented a lot of really famous authors. And so that's Bound Brook today. Joan told me all about Bound Brook then. She told me all about how she learned to paint initially in Jamaica. And then when the family came back to Wellfleet and she met Jack, when they were both, I think, students at the Rhode Island School of Design, they got married. And at quite an early age, now much older, they formed the Golden Cod Gallery, which is a well-known gallery in Wellfleet. Now, Jack is a very interesting guy. He's more edgy, to use the word we were using before, than Joan. Joan is not edgy at all. Jack is sort of edgy. But he's a very bright guy. I love his voice. He would go back to Ireland often to intermingle with the Irish artists there. He went to Paris and became quite friendly with, trying to think of the name of the guy, the Irish guy who was such a terrific artist. Maybe it'll come to me as we speak. But he had great connections, and he's in the London Museum. He's in the Metropolitan Museum in New York. He's in the National Gallery in Washington, D.C. Mm. He's in the Perlman Art Gallery, a big art gallery in Philadelphia. He's all over the place.
I have a friend who's an art collector who lives on the Vineyard. I'm sure he knows of his work. The people down on Cape Cod and on the islands are very tight. They all know who's in the art community who's worth checking out. So that's pretty cool. So is he still working? Does he still paint?
Well, you know, he's got some arthritis in his fingers. He's in a wheelchair. He's a year younger than I am. This summer we became close, and we talked about our medical problems, whatever they were. And I told him, I said to him, Jack, you want to live? He said, yeah, I want to live. I said, go to the doctor and look into that thing that's on your face, and whatever the doctor tells you to do, take care of it. So, you know, I think he will. So I spoke to, so I interviewed her, and she was wonderful on Wellfleet history. She was wonderful on art. Now, Jack is, he's a more touchy guy. So at first he said, I don't like it. I will scratch that interview, you know, and his wife heard it, Joan, and she said, I love that interview. It's a great interview.
It's happened to me. It's happened to everyone that you get somebody who's very, I think, a little insecure about sharing stuff, and then they're not sure whether they should have said what they said. But it ended up you saved the interview.
Well, actually, not only did I save the interview, but Jack came around to liking it. I pointed out to him that my object in doing the interview with him was to show how somebody can find out what they want to do very early in life. He found out what he wanted to do in life practically before he could walk, because he had the comic strips out and he was copying them. He was doing, he never wanted to be anything other than an artist from day one. So what I did in the interview is I followed his career from step to step to step to the UMass professorship and backwards the Rhode Island School of Design, and forward to his career, etchings and showings in museums and on to the present day. And the reason that Joan liked it so much is because that approach succeeded, and it showed that he was an artist from day one, day 10, 30, 50, and now 90. And yes, it succeeded very well.
Living out his dream as a young kid to get into this world and make a living at it.
Yeah, it's like you. You knew you wanted to be a painter.
Absolutely. I can't paint a straight line, but I know what I wanted to do.
Yeah. Jordan, how old were you when you decided
that? I was probably 9, 10 years old when I got my first little reel-to-reel tape deck and was fascinated with recording my voice and all that. And then in high school, I got into theater and radio club, and that was it. I was hooked. And, you know, I think those stories and these interviews are so valuable. I want to talk about another one in a sec, because you get a chance to have someone tell their story, and that story will live on forever and maybe influence in a positive way somebody on the young side who's looking to get into this.
Well, absolutely. You know, the reason that I was drawn to these historical, these oral histories is because they're going to be around long after everybody I've interviewed is gone, including me. But what they're going to do is they're going to transcribe the oral histories into text, and they're going to put the text in their library, and presumably somebody 50 or 100 years from now will come upon the two we were just talking about, Coughlin and Joan, and they're going to know a lot about Wellfleet in the era of the 2000s, early 2000s, and the 20th century, and historically what those people tell about Wellfleet in the past. I think it's historical, and that's what drew me to it.
Let's talk about one more that you interviewed, and this gentleman's name is Jeremy Young. What is his story?
Well, let's talk about Richard Rosenthal.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me fix that. I mean, I skipped. I put the line in the wrong place.
So listen to this.
Hold on. Let me redo that so that we get it right. Let's talk about a few other individuals that you interviewed, the next one being Richard Rosenthal.
Yeah, Richard Rosenthal was so interesting. It's an unbelievable story, Jordan. Rich was another one who refused to be interviewed by the Historical Society. Now, what happened with that is that Richard refused initially. Why did he refuse? Because as a photographer, one of the many things he does splendidly, he created a book when the – do you know Wellfleet at all?
I've only been once or twice passing through mostly. So.
Well, one of the prime landmarks in Wellfleet is called Uncle Tim's Bridge. It joins the mainland to the part of Wellfleet where there's a hill called Cannon Hill. And if you go around Cannon Hill or over Cannon Hill, you'll come to the railroad trestle that now is in ruins, which was when they first brought the railroad to Cape Cod well over 100 years ago. And then if you go on, you come around to the part of the land that faces the Wellfleet Marina across a body of water. And if you continue on from there, you come to a cliff with houses on it. Well, it's an absolutely splendid walk. And Uncle Tim's Bridge, which is one of those wooden bridges, you know, got out of repair and was rotting away in 2014. So they decided that they could renovate the bridge. And that was a big industrial thing with cranes and workmen, and took a while to do. And Richard Rosenthal photographed it all and put together a book dedicated to the Wellfleet Historical Society, the renovation of Uncle Tim's Bridge, about a 40-page book with pictures of the renovation and kids and people and workmen, and in the distance, the great Congregational Church, houses in down in the mud, in the flats below the
bridge. Is this his vocation or his career?
Oh, wait a minute, I'll tell you.
Oh, okay. I can't wait.
So Richard had refused, and I tried to get in touch with him, and he refused. And I'd never met him up to that point. So toward the end of the summer, the Wellfleet Historical Society had a big party. A couple of hundred people attended, and Lois and I went, and we had a great time. On our way out the door, and I wanted to interview the fire chief during that period. Richard was the police chief, get this.
Oh, okay.
From 1990 to 2011. So I run into Dan Silverman. I don't know, two Jewish guys. One's a fire chief and one's a police chief. So anyway, Dan is known to be a terrific guy and very knowledgeable. And I wanted to interview him, but he had already been interviewed. But Lois and I are walking out, and I see a guy, something, does anybody know Dan Silverman? Yeah, there he is right next to you. I said, my God. So I said, Dan, I'm Larry Rubin, and I wanted to interview. Anyway, his wife was there, Lois was there. We talked for like 8 or 9 minutes, and he knows Richard Rosenthal. It came to light later. And I told him that I wanted to interview Richard Rosenthal. I couldn't get him. He said, oh, that's too bad. But we had a very lovely conversation among the four of us for not very long. And I did as I usually do. I talked a lot and in my way and didn't think much about it afterwards. Then I get a call or an email, I forget which, from Richard Rosenthal saying, okay, I'll do the interview. So I said to myself, how did that happen? Well, I deduced that. I'm not sure. I wrote Silverman about it, and I said, I don't know whether you did this, but I can't think of any other way that he would have turned around unless you spoke to him and said something like, well, this guy's okay, let him interview. But anyway, I'm happy to be interviewing him. And Dan never answered whether it was him or not. I don't know, but I don't know who else would have done it, because Rosenthal at this point in his life is not running around talking to a million people. The reason that Richard Rosenthal is so interesting is that he's one of the most famous police chiefs in the country. He started out in the New York Police Department, and his first job as a rookie cop was to infiltrate the Jewish Defense League and Maya Kahane, which he did successfully. And he talked about that. He also is a gun expert. He has lots of presently he lives over the winter. He lives out in Arizona, near Tucson. But during the summer, he likes to come back to Wellfleet, because even though he'd never seen Wellfleet before he took over the police department in 1990, he got to love it here. Yes, Jordan.
The reason I interject earlier was I was under the impression that he was a master photographer, which he obviously is, but a law enforcement background that's pretty extensive. I didn't see that coming. That's why we do these things, you and I purposely don't want to know a lot about what you're going to come up with. So— where is he now? What is he doing now, in other words? Is he retired?
He does everything. He's a Renaissance man.
Wow.
He's a famous police chief. He's one of the most famous in the country. You can look him up on the internet. Mm-hmm. Why is he famous? Because he's like no police chief. We think of police chiefs as police chiefs. When he came to Wellfleet, instead of commanding these guys from afar, he got to know them as people. And he was extremely popular with his force, which at one time, because of all the tourism in the summer, came to 16 or 17 offices. But when I got to know him, when I interviewed him, I thought it was going to be a straightforward interview. Went on for an hour and a half. And why? Because I was so fascinated. Here is this guy who's like no police chief I've ever met, who really is super educated, who's written and published 10 or 12 books, and who speaks in a fashion that makes you realize right away that he's a super educated person with fantastic ideas, who's not only a gun expert but a photographer, and does many things as hobbies to perfection.
That's the definition of a Renaissance man, really.
Yeah, he is. I think he is. And, you know, I'm not impressed that easily by people because I've talked to so many people, famous people. I mean, I am impressed by them. But, like, this came as a surprise to you. It came as a surprise to me. And I realized during the interview that I was sitting across from a very, very exceptional person.
Let me suggest, too, that I know you so well, and we've been doing these podcasts for years now. You are very comfortable asking questions as well as delivering answers. And I think that's a skill set, certainly one that I have, and I've been working at it for years. So they picked the right guy, I think, the Historical Society, to get these interviews down after failing to do so in you.
Well, I think so, actually. I don't want to be falsely modest. I think that it had something to do with my personality and my approach. But I'm so happy because in this interview that I'm talking about, he and I exchanged ideas all through it. And I think anybody listening to it we're not going to be as fascinated as I was, but they'll be fascinated.
Here's a producer and editor note. Larry realized he had one more story to share, a very important one. He said, "Can I call it in?" I said, "This is your podcast. You can do whatever you'd like." So here's the question I posed to Larry to set up the story. Larry, you were telling us about Chief Rosenthal and the book that he wrote about the renovation of the landmark Uncle Tim's Bridge. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I sure can. And thank you very much for this opportunity to amend what we were doing the other day, Jordan, because I think this is important. I think it's important for several reasons. First of all, I didn't know that I would form such a close friendship with, well, I wouldn't say a close friendship, but a friendship because of the story about Uncle Tim's Bridge. And also about the history of Wellfleet in terms of his being a police chief and going back even further than that. And I think it's also about giving back. In other words, using whatever talents I may have when I hear something that's so horrific as an historical society refusing an obviously beautifully done history of their own town. That amazed me and horrified me, as it would anybody with any historical sense or even a sense of decency. So it's a story about using my own talents, whatever they are, to give back and to make sure that gets into the proper hands. And it's also about empathy, which may go under friendship, but it's empathy in the sense that I am reacting to something that Richard really couldn't do for himself. And as you will hear the story develop, what happened is that he empowered me to speak for him to the Historical Society, now under different management, and get this book where it should be. And that is an interesting thing, and it's also a very valuable thing. And I was honored to be able to do that. So, you know, when Richard first came over to my house and I first met him, he did bring that book along with him that I mentioned, the one he presented to the Historical Society about the refashioning or the rebuilding of Uncle Tim's Bridge. But it wasn't until a little bit later when he invited me to his house and in Wellfleet, and Lois and I went over there, my wife, Lois, and met with him and his wife, Frauke. Well, Frauke is an amazing woman herself. She served on the Wellfleet Fire Department for many years. He met her almost 60 years ago. He's going to celebrate his 60th like I am, a little bit sooner in my case, maybe 4 or 5 years in his case. A German girl that he met, and he told a funny story about he picked out the girl at the dance who had the nicest legs, and that was Frauke. Well, Frauke's a terrific lady. She grew up in bad times in Germany, and she's been here for quite a while. And both of them key in the history of Wellfleet. He is a police chief, and chief with the fire department for many years. So we went over there, and I had a chance over there to look at the book more closely, to meet with Rich and his wife, and that was a very nice meeting for both Lois and me. And I told them, again, how horrified I was that the Wealthy Historical Society back in 2008 didn't accept the book when he presented it to him, when he presented it to them. And that was very hurtful to him. And, you know, he's very talented. The book is beautiful. It's obviously beautiful, beautifully done, has many other features, as they may have mentioned, about people and kids and all the rest of the church, things that got into the photographs. So as one thing developed into another during this visit, and the idea came that he should write a new dedication to the book, and that I would act for him in presenting that to the Historical Society. And I told him it was under new management, better management, people who recognize history. And what happened then was that he empowered me to speak in his stead. He really couldn't do it for himself. I could do it because my relationship had developed with my go-to at the society and one of the directors of the society, a very lovely lady by the name of Robin Burns, and she's lived in Wellesley for years. So that he did a new dedication, and let me see if I can get back to that. I had it up on my email. Okay, so the dedication was done at his home, September 23, 2023. These photos were taken by me during the teardown and replacement of Uncle Tim's bridge. I happily donate this book to the Wellfleet Historical Society for future Wellfleetians to see. Richard Rosenthal, Wellfleet Chief of Police, retired January 15, 1990 to September 30, 2010. And that was really nice. And so I took that, I took the book and the dedication, he wrote it in, signed it, and I took it to my own home, and I called up Robin and told her that I wanted to come and see her, told her a little bit about what it was about, not all. I wrote a quite long, I would say, essay to the Historical Society, directed to her as the director and all the other members, about 8 or 10 of them, of the Wellfleet Historical Society, and wrote up a lot of the things I've been telling you and saying how horrified I was, and that the book should be accepted by the Historical Society. Well, to not go into too much detail, the book was accepted by the Historical Society. Robin was wonderful about it. As a matter of fact, when I presented it to her at the Historical Society's premises, where the museum is, I said to her, and it came as a surprise, maybe you'd like to say something, Robin. And she started out saying, well, I'm not used to speaking publicly on something like this. All of this was recorded, of course. But she did, and she spoke very nicely how honored they were to receive this. And a little bit later, Robin wrote to me that she wanted to write in her own hand, so to speak, to Richard to say how much the society enjoyed receiving that and was honored by receiving that. And by that time, Richard was on his way by land, I guess, driving out to his winter home in Arizona. And she sent what she wrote to me, and it was beautifully expressive, and it showed how the Historical Society had turned around 180 degrees on this. And I wrote back to her that I wasn't going to write to Richard what it was. Let him be surprised when he got to it, because she mailed it, and when it got to his home in Arizona. And that hasn't happened yet, because he would have been in touch with me, but I wanted him to be surprised by it, because it will be so meaningful to him when he receives that. And she also put in that they'd be honored if he came when he returns next summer to come to the society. And I suggested to her that maybe they'll want to have some sort of honorific for him. And I also suggested that I saw a lot of his other photographic books, many of them centered on Wellfleet, and they probably could use others of them. So that it's really a nice story, and it has a lot to do with, as I said at the outset, of this, Jordan. This is one of the few times I've spoken and you've never interrupted me. And I love it when you interrupt me because you always have great things to say and ask. Maybe you'll have something after this. But in any event, I have told the story, and I think that it's a story that is complete with values that should be high in our society: friendship, empathy, giving back, history, community. All those things are so valuable. And this tells that story in a very personal way. And I was really honored to be the person to be chosen by Richard. He trusted me to do this, and that made me feel very good. So it's good on all ends.
A fine story to add, even if you did have to call it in. And now back to our in-studio conversation. Let's move on, because of time, to one more, and this gentleman's name is Jeremy Young. What makes him special?
Well, I'm always looking for something special. Now, Jeremy was not one that they had difficulty getting, but Jeremy Young, like you and some other people who are very lucky, knew what he wanted to do very young and start building and forming his business when he was 15.
Mm.
He's been working at that business ever since. Well, he and his wife own a hotel that was passed down through the family, called the, I'm trying to think of the name, the Wellfleet something or other. But it's been there for a long time. But his main job is as a landscaper, and he's our landscaper. And I'm seeking to find out. First of all, Jeremy's a very handsome guy. He's very well-skilled at what he does. People in Wellfleet love him. They think of him as a leader. He's well-known in the town. His father was well-known in the town. He's not somebody who comes out and talks about himself. I think one of the reasons that he talked a good deal in our interview is because we know each other very well. He's been my landscaper for like 10 or 12 years. We look to Jeremy to take care of us, Lois and I. She loves him too. To take care of us if we're lucky enough to live long enough to stay in Wellfleet, long enough to need more help than we need now. But even now we need help. And he watches the house during the winter, landscapes it in the summer, helps us inside the house when necessary. And he married a young woman who's got a bigger family than he has. So now he's spread out. They have a couple of kids. And I'm looking for the hook to show how exceptional this seemingly ordinary guy is, who does something fairly ordinary. It turns out that the hook is what I just mentioned to you. Like Jordan Rich, he is like you. Imagine, from 15, he doesn't read books. He pays attention to his work, and that is what he does, probably 24 hours a day in one form or another.
These people, all of them we've mentioned in the podcast, are all focused individuals, aren't they?
Yes.
Super focused.
Super focused. I'd say Jeremy is super focused on what he does. So what happened is that the tape recorder cut off, who knows why, just before the end of our interview. So I wrote to Jeremy. I said, we were just starting to talk about your life on your boat. You had a boat, and where he went. Why don't you reconstruct what you said, and I'll put it in. So he did. He reconstructed it. And then I reconstructed some questions and answers to bring out that the hook more strongly, that here is an unusual person that knew what he wanted to do from the time he was 15 and was in business, making money, from the time he was 15.
I can identify with that, absolutely. I was spinning records at parties when I was 18 and starting my studio work when I was 19, 20. And there are lots of people in the world, as you know, Larry. You've met so many of them, and many are very happy having others guide them along the way and fall into place and follow the leader. But these are all very individualistic people, very focused people.
They are very focused people, and I'm glad that I was able to end the interview and get the Historical Society to put the ending on what he said and then how I built it to it.
Welcome to my world. That's what always, you know, that it's always putting puzzles together and sound and audio clips and things like that, or in your case, writing them. Are these going to be pretty much text-oriented pieces?
Yeah, they will be changed. The audio will be
transcribed
and put in books and up on their shelves. And the last thing he said, I got in. I said, "Well, is there anything I haven't covered, Jeremy?" That this is made up after the thing shut off. But he did say this. I said, "Is there anything that I haven't covered that you'd like to say?" He said, "Well, I'm happy to do this interview, Larry, because I want it to be heard by people and families who come after me and after us." That was a great answer.
Very good answer. And a very good discussion about your taking on a mission that others didn't have an opportunity to or didn't want to, and I think you succeeded. Larry, as always.
Wait 1 second. Oh. The last person on your list, this won't take long, is Larry Ruttman.
Well, wait a minute. We started out by saying you were interviewed. Do you have something to add to that?
Yeah, my interview, but I'm not going to tell you the whole thing. That's for another time. I was interviewed as well as interviewing all these other people. But I was interviewed by a very lovely lady, Beth Whitman, and she came over and she was very well prepared. And we talked for over an hour about my experiences in Wellfleet. Well, I couldn't believe, looking backwards, how many people I knew, how many things I was involved in Wellfleet. And we talked all about that. And that's for another time.
There's always going to be another time because there's always more to say. Absolutely. Well, as an interviewer myself, I commend you. I say well done, and may there be more of these projects ahead. I'm sure there will be.
Well, I hope so, Jordan. I hope life goes on for a while. Now I know more about you every time. I know how young you were when you started, and now I know why I think so much of you, because you're great at what you do.
I'm never going to say no to you coming into the studio and offering me compliments. Thank you, my friend.
My pleasure.
This has been A Life Lived Backwards, One Man's Life, the accompanying podcast to Larry Ruttman's memoir, A Life Lived Backwards, an existential triad of friendship, inquisitiveness, and maturation. You can subscribe and download this podcast, available on all podcast platforms. For information on Larry, his books, lectures, and much more, visit the website larryruttman.com. Also check out the extensive Larry Ruttman page on Wikipedia. This is Jordan Rich inviting you to join us again next time as Larry shares more stories about friendship, inquisitiveness, and maturation on A Life Lived Backwards, One Man's Life.